Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 98-year-old Bill Jukes of Bakersfield, California, originally from Croswell, Michigan, but his World War II service as a pilot came in the Royal Canadian Air Force.
I'm curious about something else too, because, you know, almost every veteran that I've had the privilege of interviewing was living in the United States when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Here you are already in the military in Canada when that happened, but I'm interested on your perspective, and because for any American, it was a world changer and an eye-opener. For you, being in the Canadian Air Force already, when Japan attacked America and then the U.S. entered the war, was that a significant development from your view?
Well, yeah, a lot of the United States airmen who had come up to Canada went back home to the United States. And I remember Pearl Harbor, that's when we got the United States into the war. We realized that England needed help. England was alone, you know. Hitler gobbled up all the small nations in Europe, just grabbed them and took over. And England was all alone, and France had fallen, so England needed the United States.
So how early did you go overseas, and what were you doing when you got there?
Went overseas in 1944. I went over on a troop ship in the Queen Mary, which was operated by the United States Navy. We landed at a little harbor in Scotland, Greenock, is anchored in the harbor, and we were picked up with lighters and taken by train all the way down from Scotland down to Bournemouth in England, and that's when we were put in little hotels until we were posted. From there, first of all, they sent us to an English family, and we spent a week, I think, there with them to learn their English customs and what have you, which was a good idea. We already had our wings then, you know. I had 600 and some odd hours, but that RAF military training, how to fit into an English squadron and that sort of thing, and we learned tactics and that sort of thing.
And what were you flying at that point?
Mark V Spitfires, yeah. Early Spitfires, yeah. And they had a big airplane called the Master, which was around 600 horsepower engine. It was a big trainer airplane. They taught you instrument flying and that sort of thing in that. But most of our flying was in the early Spitfires.
What'd you think of that plane?
Oh, God, that was, you know, just the feel. A Spitfire has a feel unlike any other airplane. It just seems to flow. I don't know what it is. Whether that was psychological or actually, who knows, you know, but that was my goal. I got to fly a Spitfire. Then we had all sorts of training. Actually, the squadron I ended up in, we worked with the 2nd Tactical Air Force, and we worked with the British Army, and they gave us the targets, things like a bridgehead where they were backed up and had problems, and we went in and strafed it and that sort of thing. So actually, we were a tool of the Army right then.
Were most of the other pilots in your squadron British?
Yes, but the squadron that I ended up in, we had Dutch, all allies, weren't 100% British pilots, Canadians like myself, and Americans who had not transferred back in Canada and were over there in the RCAF, but they were Americans. And most of those people transferred eventually to the Army Air Corps. How I got to fly a P-51 or a Mustang, we called it, that just happened. It was a transitional school where we were trying to get into operational aircraft. And the group I was with, we were slated to fly Typhoons, which was a big engine, fighter. It was strictly a ground attack type airplane. We hated it. We all wanted to fly Spitfire. So we were sent to this place called Honnelly, H-O-N-I-L-Y, a transitional type aerodrome. And we hated it, you know. We would pull all the strings you could to try to get into the Spitfire. Here are Canadians over there getting operational training in the Spitfire. We're sitting here. They hadn't sent us our Typhoons yet. We were billeted in this group of 12 or 14, and we were in the civilian family where the IRCs, we called them, the mechanics and the ground crew, they lived there in these little cottages, their family, and that's where they lived. And of course, they moved out and we were billeted there. And the next little cottage was a loner, a guy all by himself. He wore civilian clothes, and all he was doing was practicing fly casting. He had a tire laid out here, and he tried to cast it. So I said to the guys, we had a whole conglomeration of packages from Canada, you know, and we're going to have a big feed, pulled it all together and gorge ourselves on. So I got to talking to this guy here. If it was okay, it would go if I'd invite him to come and join us. Yeah, sure. So the night of this big party, food orgy, who should show up? Wing commander. This guy put all the dress uniform, you know, and everything coming to the party. Anyway, during the evening, he said to me, I've been sent here to set up a training conversion course on a Mustang airplane. And he said, possibly you might be able to recommend some people. I need 12 bods, that's bodies, 12 people. I said, yes, sir, I think I could do get you 12 people. So I said to the guys, he said, hey, that hangar with those strange-looking airplanes in there are Mustangs, and we get to fly them if you want. And you'll have absolutely anything but that Typhoon. So we set up it was a Canadian pilot, Mustang. Canadians had a Mustang squadron there, and he was on arrest. You know, you got so many hours, and you could get twitchy, and they'd put you on the leave, you know. And this guy, he was really a screw-up, you know. He stole the station CEO's car and hooked it up to a farmer's hay wagon and got a bunch of wafts and take them on a hay ride, and he ran them in the ditch, and they all just terrible. Anyway, he was a terrific pilot, a Mustang pilot. So he set up this demonstration. We're sitting there by the control tower and sitting on the grass, and he shows up and he's terrific, loops and slow rolls and barrel rolls and you name it. And we're right in front of us demonstrating this airplane. Man, we were all hooked right there. Yeah. So that's when a group set up, and we moved to another aerodrome that wasn't being used at the time. It set up like a squadron, a CO, and the whole thing was set up. And that we trained as a squadron. And then from there, we went to a pilot pool in the south of England. And as they needed, and of course the invasion just started and was going on.
The invasion of Normandy.
And they needed replacements, you know. So two other guys and myself, I didn't even know them, were there, and we were said to report to the little aerodrome there. We got on this little Anson there, twin-engine airplane, an Anson. No seats or anything. We sat on our parachutes, and we went to Normandy and joined the squadron. I can remember the sergeant pilot, and the pilot was letting him fly, and he got across the bomb line and got lost in the fog, and they were shooting, German army were shooting at us. You could smell the cordite, you know, and stuff, and such as, man, they're going to get us before we even get started, you know. The pilot took over, and he wandered around, found his way back to a little mat strip of chicken wire and what have you. They had an an airstrip there, and there were two squadrons of Mustangs there operating, 65 squadron and 19 squadron, and we lived in tents and what have you. And at that time, we were helping, of course, the Army, and we were bombing. We had a 1,000-pounder bomb under each wing on a Mustang and fly over and drop these bombs on the marshaling yard and the trains station and what have you, and the barges on the Seine River, things like that. That's all we did. And then when I got hurt, we had a American Army, the British Army, and the Canadian Army had surrounded a German Army, FALAIS, and they eventually destroyed that German Army, just wiped it out. So then we would take off in pairs, fly to the Falaise area and take our target. We had, where I got hit, a senior German officer would have a little motorhome that would be where he lived, out in the field. Our job was to destroy that, to strafe it and set it on fire and burn. And this flight commander that I was flying number two, he said, okay, I'll go down, you stay up here and keep sure the coast is clear. And he finally ran out of ammunition. He could make this little thing burst into flame. He said, now you go down. But by this time, it was pretty fiery down there. So I go down. And I broke a rule there. You never made three passes on the same target, because if you did, they'd get you. The German ground gunners were very accurate. And dummy, I made a third pass. And I hear my leader saying, don't go. Don't go, come back up. And I pretended I didn't hear him, and all of a sudden, thump, boy, when you get hit, you know you're hit. And he got me on the left wheel. I didn't know this, because you can't see your wheels from the cockpit. And it destroyed that wheel. It probably still bouncing right on there. Anyway, and I was able to fly back, but when I got back to our strip, we had a hard and fast rule that you did not crash on that strip, because that would, there'd be no more flying operations on the, you ruined that strip, you go crash somewhere else. Yeah. So I got a red flare. It was radio silence. The bomb line was right close there. So I opened up and went around, turned around. I was about on my first turn from takeoff. And the engine let a big gulch of flame and quit. And then it picked up again, just kind of idling, no power. And that's a bad place to try to make a forced landing, because it's all those little fields with hedgerows, you know, with the trees growing on them, and little 40-acre fields, you know. No field of any size. So I don't know what the hell to do. I got them down here. I knew I had to get this damn airplane on the ground and how to do it. So we were taught, if you're in the trees, and if you're going to hit some trees, hit them, one on each wing, and it'll shear your wings off and slow you down, and you may survive. So I picked these two trees, and I went down, lined up, and... And it went through. It didn't stop me. And I'm headed for the revetments where all our operational airplanes are lined up there. I knew I didn't dare crash there. So being right-handed, I turned to the right. And I should have turned left, because it was open ground there. Instead, I just instinctively, I turned to the right, and I was heading this hedgerow and these big trees, giant trees, row of trees, and another row across here. So here I am, and I'm committed. So I didn't want to hit the base, you know, because that's solid, you know. So I pull up, and I hit this horizontal row of trees, and I knocked a piece of my left wing off, and so the airplane, the right wing lifted, and I turned and I hit the other row of trees and crashed down in and crashed. That's where I crashed. So, of course, when you crash, you don't feel a thing. If you're going to die, that's the way to go. because you can't feel, you don't feel anything. Everything's numb.
We need to catch our final break, but the story gets even more incredible when we come back. For photos of our guest today, Bill Jukes, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll come right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.